a very cultured fellow. Mr. Kurt Loder, next on Culture Catch.
Influencing the influencers. Smart culture. CultureCatch.com.
Today's show is sponsored by our friends at Napa Piri. For cutting-edge sportswear from Italy, visit NapaPiri.com.
Joining me today on the Culture Catch, here we are, the esteemed colleague, writing colleague, who's actually more than just a writer. He's an on-air personality, Mr. Kurt Loder.
How you doing? Good to be here.
Thanks. Kurt, how did you happen upon the whole phenomena that became a juggernaut in the TV business?
What are you talking about?
Your career. Come on, your career arc, man. Give us a little backstory.
Well, I backed into it. It was totally by accident. I was working at Rolling Stone for a long time. And one day I got a call from somebody at MTV, and they said, would you like to be on television? And it was a lot more money in television for doing a lot less, oddly. So I said, yeah. And there I was. I mean, I'm not a television person. And I don't see myself having a career in television, really. But there I was for a long time.
Did you find it odd to kind of be like the go-to person for that particular brand of pop culture at the time in that time frame?
Well, I wasn't the go-to person for like boy groups or anything.
No, of course
like
not. But I mean, you were like you were like the voice of reason in a yeah. sea of and you know. Sea
well,
of
it's
fluff.
Easy. It's easy to be an expert and seem very knowledgeable on television because. You know, how much competition is there? So I know a lot of people who know a lot more than I do, who are writers and stuff, and don't get paid anywhere near what they deserve to.
Right. Well, that seems to be the edict of every writer.
Yeah.
You never get, you know, then the few that break through
yeah.
get paid very handsomely.
It's true.
The trickle-down effect doesn't seem to work in the...
Writers are always screwed.
Yeah. I mean,
always. It never fails.
Why do you think that is? I mean, just...
People have no respect for writers. They don't think they're very important. I mean, you find this in Hollywood a lot, too. And people say, there's a great line in this movie, Shadow of the Vampire, which is about a vampire movie being made. And the guy who's the star actually is a vampire. And he says at one point, he says, do we really need the writers? Because he's looking for somebody to, like, drain. And, you know, Gore Vidal says, when people say that movies are an auteur medium, and the director is everything. He said, movies couldn't be made without people writing them. They just couldn't. And writers in music are like historians also. They compile so many facts, so stuff that would be lost, and they're so important. And I don't think that'll be realized until years in the future, probably.
Right. You know, you make two very good points, and I want to address the writing of the movies first, the writers who write movies, screenplays. I mean, we know when there's bad language. No direction can cover that up.
Yeah.
And it's just so apparent. So when you find a great movie that maybe doesn't have the budget and you fall in love with the language and the dialogue and the characters.
Yeah.
And it's a whole different medium than writing fiction.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, a script can make a movie. It doesn't matter how much, you know, Juno is just brilliantly written. It's so funny. And it costs like $5 to make, but
right.
It doesn't matter. It's a classic. So scripts are very, very important. I think we've reached the point where the number of explosions in a movie isn't really that important anymore because we've seen it all. The computer-generated imagery, we've seen it all. I find it really boring. So I think there'll always be a return to good writing.
You know, unless you've reached some kind of apex in your CGI portfolio, yes, we have. You know, The Matrix was revolutionary when it came out. And Transformers to an extent because the way they worked the blue screen in with the CGI was pretty seamless. But you're right, you know, how do you keep topping it? Actually, I read something, I forget what movie, maybe it's the latest Bond movie where they said we didn't use CGI. Or one of the action movies of the summer, they were proud to say
that's true.
You know, the stunts are real. We're not flying things on blue screens.
And which one was that? Because
it wasn't the Bond, but it was something this summer that came out, and they were really I had to champion him on that cause. That's fantastic.
That's great. I mean, if you look back at like George Miller movies, the Mad Max movies, they were doing that stuff for real, and it was dangerous. You know,
right.
You could get killed.
Maybe it was the Death Race movie. No, it wasn't the Death Race. I haven't seen Death Race, so I couldn't.
No,
couldn't,
you know what it, you know what it was? It was the remake of Death Race. Yeah,
it was.
Their whole thing is that it's real.
It's all real. The crash.
Unfortunately,
the,
movie blows, but you know, it's real.
And that's Kurt's one-line review.
Well, yeah,
of Death Race.
Yeah. I write about movies, and that was sort of my wrap-up on that.
That's the Spinal Tap. You know, the shark sandwich review.
Jason Statham, I just don't understand. I mean, I'm puzzled. Vin Diesel, Jason Statham, have you ever seen them together? I just don't understand the appeal of those people.
They'll be in a Prison Break movie soon.
Absolutely. Or a Women in Prison movie would be much more interesting.
Now let's move, you know, let's move into music journalism, because you read, I read a lot of 4- and 5-star reviews today, and I just shake my head and I say, then what are the classics? 20-star reviews?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of, there are a lot of writers online particularly who bandy about these star ratings, and you're just like, what are they listening to?
Yeah.
I guess they have no historical perspective because they're young writers. Maybe they're lazy writers. I don't know. What is it, Kurt?
I think it was a very bad thing when the star system started being used by People magazine, I think, pioneered that in like the 1970s when that started. And people should realize that a magazine, when people are giving out stars, it's always someone different. Like, this reviewer will give this movie 4 stars. But this reviewer might have given it 1 star, but he didn't review the movie. So you're only getting one person's opinion, and it means nothing. You know,
right.
What's a 3-star record? What does that mean?
Yeah.
Velvet Underground records. They never sold.
Right.
What does that mean?
Right.
It doesn't mean anything. You know?
Yeah.
You hope that a reviewer is a good writer. Critics are very rare. I think of reviewers as being just about everybody. And a critic is somebody who really has a deep knowledge of things, like Pauline Kael in movies, are so rare. So a reviewer should be try to be concise and sum it up and not be too emotional and say this is the end of Western culture or anything like that. It's hard to do, but I mean, you know, nothing will replace seeing the movie or hearing the music. I mean, you should really do it for yourself. I think a lot of starred reviews, it's been pointed out by other people, give people something to say at cocktail parties. You know, you just see the 5 stars and you say, oh, must be great. And then you go to a party and you say, oh, that movie, yeah, great. That was fabulous. And they have no idea.
So it's Cliff Notes. You're using Cliff Notes.
Yeah, it's taken the place of actually experiencing whatever it is we're talking about.
How about your contemporary writers? Who are those that you really fancy?
Well,
in any medium, it doesn't have to be music. It could be, you mentioned Paul.
I think Anthony Lane is just one of the greatest critics, one of the greatest writers. He's just phenomenal. Gary Giddens is such a great jazz writer and also a movie writer. And Alex Ross with The New Yorker. Anybody can make classical music come alive.
Right.
He's just a genius.
A medium that gets no respect at all. I don't know if the young generation even appreciates classical music, if there's any understanding.
Yeah. There's so much of it. You know, I think part of the problem might be that. I mean, how many Bach cello suites can you buy? There are about 40 different ones.
Right.
But he's really great.
He's fantastic.
Yeah, he's really, really good. Music writers, I don't know. I mean, I keep up because I just listen to this stuff and I don't read about it.
How about somebody like Lester? Was it more hype, or did you enjoy his gonzo style?
He was great. Lester was so important at the time. He seemed to be punk rock, you know, and I think he reveled in that. I think he said once, he posed the question, can America's greatest writer actually be somebody who just writes record reviews? And I think the answer, as we see now, is no. He should have done a book or something, and I'm not sure how well that stuff stands up now.
Right.
I haven't read his stuff, but in retrospect, I wonder about this hyperbolic, like I'm crazy and I'm wiped out. I'm not sure that would play today.
Well, that was the criticism of Hunter S. Thompson. That was his own albatross as well.
He
always fancied himself as a real writer,
and
he never was able to break through the gonzo style.
You know, David Felton, who edited him at Rolling Stone, always said that cocaine turns your brain to concrete. And I think, you know, after there was that, there was Fear and Loathing, there's Hell's Angels. And really after that, after Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail, mainly, after that he didn't really do anything.
Right.
He just took drugs.
Right.
And it's funny if you look back and you think, but in the 60s and 70s, people were so obsessed with drugs. You'd spend days waiting for drugs, and you'd take the drugs, and you'd go back to waiting for drugs again. And I think young people must look at that today and think, what was that about? Didn't you have something better to do? And that's like just a vanished era. I'm not sure if people could even understand it anymore.
Okay, I'm getting interference. We'll have to do that again.
Oh, good.
The iPhone, which I need to turn off because I don't know if you've noticed this. If you have an iPhone and you have it next to your computer,
mm-hmm.
it does bizarre things and it makes this weird noise. So I have to power this thing down.
Yeah, it's too cool.
Yeah, it's and I mean, what is it doing to our brains?
all
of this Wi-Fi technology is scrambling our atoms.
I have a BlackBerry. I hate it, but somebody gave it to me. So
well, there you go. Okay, so we were on the tangent of overhyped writers. Well, there's certainly a lot of overhype in everything today.
Yeah, it's, Keith Richards says 90% of everything is garbage.
Yeah, I tend to agree with him with pop culture.
Yeah,
and when you do find something that you really like, or that if it reaches an arc in the in the general population as something really special and unique, and it has longevity. But like you said, the Velvet Underground never sold any records.
Yeah.
You know, there are many bands like that. The New York Dolls didn't sell any records when they came out.
So I don't think anyone approaches the Velvet Underground. It wasn't said that nobody bought the records, but everybody that did went out and started a band.
Right.
I think is very true. Yeah, they were very, very influential. That music is just timeless. If you listen to Velvet Underground records, it doesn't sound like a 60s, like 60s music. There's no phasing on it. There's no guitar noodling and all that garbage. It inhabits its own space, and it's classic. You know, it's very rare to find something like that.
That and the old R&B, and this is an issue I had with Prince. Was I've always felt that his music dates very quickly. He's always a slave to the new technologies, and I'd love to hear him doing something organic. Or when he does do something organic, it really resonates.
If you see him live, he just knocks you out.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
Prince is he's the greatest guitar player walking a stage. And you just go, whoa.
He's effortless.
Yeah, he's so, so good. I think he puts out too much music is probably the...
Well, he has nobody to edit him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a very strong personality, and as genius as he is, you do need editors from time to time.
Oh, sure. Yeah, everybody does. I think any writer, if they're honest, will say that. Like, God, what do I do without an editor? And a fact checker. So important.
Yeah, exactly. You're working on a new book.
I'm trying to do a memoir, and my problem is that I just don't remember a lot.
Too many drugs, man.
Yeah, it's that drug and drink thing, and it's very hard to remember it. So you actually have to do research for it. I think the greatest memoir I've read is Palimpsest by Gore Vidal, and even he says you have to go back, and wherever you're talking about, go back to it and experience it again. And you have to look it up, and you have to go through all your papers and pictures and everything. It's just a lot of work. You
know, you'd
think you'd just say, well, I was born, but that would be boring. You know, if the first 14 chapters took you up to the time I was 9, nobody would want to read this.
What are some of your early rock and roll memories that you've uncovered to date?
I don't want to give this all away.
give us a little taste. Come on, we want to hype you a little bit.
Well, I'm old enough to remember before there was rock and roll. So I remember like 50s pop, and which was stupid, and yet the stupid part sort of prepared you for what was to come later, like the Ramones. So I remember that. I remember early rock and roll. You couldn't really play Little Richard on the radio today.
Oh, no way.
On a rock station. No. It's just too raucous.
But
all those records, I think if you look back, especially R&B records, since they were done in different studios and they didn't have the technology of today, every studio had its own sound. I mean, Motown has its own sound, but you know, like Sea of Love was recorded in a closet down in Louisiana somewhere, and it's just you couldn't replicate that sound. I talked to Phil Collins about that once because he was doing Motown covers. He said the problem is you have nothing but this new technology. You can't get that sound anymore. And it's funny to go to a studio now, and there are special programs and they even bring in old, like analog machinery just to try to capture it.
Right.
It's very funny.
I know, because then it gets converted to a digital signal anyway.
Yeah,
and you lose all the... And, you know, you're talking about the natural warmth of the reverb of a particular room and the way it's been tuned and the dynamics of the placement of the mic. In many instances, it was one mic, this early stuff. And what was baffled? Were the drums baffled or the bass or the guitar amp? It's so true. You listen to the rawness of that early Elvis and Chuck Berry and... Even the early country stuff, I mean, Johnny Cash would never get played today. You know, the outlaw stuff that or David Alan Cohn. Come on, are you kidding me?
Yeah, he had a lot of it was done live too. I mean, like the later Buddy Holly stuff after he moved to New York was done in this place called the Pythian Temple, which is way uptown, and it's
in the 70s.
Like big Egyptian building or something. It's just like a huge ballroom, and they put him up on the stage. and they'd have a string section, which they, you know, they're ready to go, and they'd do it three times, and that was it. That was your record. It was all done at once. There were no overdubs or anything.
Right.
And you listen to that stuff now, you say, wow, you know, that's amazing.
Yeah. Now you're not sure if you're getting the real voice.
Yeah,
everything's
no
all auto-tuned, and what I really hate is people that slave, unless you're doing techno music or something that's ambient, and they slave to a click track. Mm. But good God, can we get rid of the click tracks? Yeah. Can we hear? I don't care if the chorus speeds up a little bit.
Yeah.
It's exciting. That's what's beautiful about live music.
I think that's what's great about, I hesitate to say indie music, but music that they don't have the money to do it the way chart music is done. And I spent a lot of time on emusic.com. And that's like the world's greatest repository of worldwide indie music. And the stuff you hear on it is just amazing. Those records cost nothing, and they're so fresh. You know, some of 90% of it is garbage, of course. But the good stuff is just incredible. I mean, I spend no time listening to chart music. I don't listen to radio. I just have no interest in it. It just doesn't move me anymore. Nothing against it, but...
No, when you can be your own DJ, and like you said, you can investigate, and there's all these other sites, and you have referrals, and you know everyone's sending you MP3s. I agree wholeheartedly. When you find that gem in the rough, when you find that low five nugget that somebody did on the Pro Tools rig.
Yeah. It's a shame that U.S. radio is so bad, though, because radio used to be able to turn you on to stuff. I mean, you'd hear something, all of a sudden you go, wow, what was that? You know, and you'd go out and try and find it.
Even the satellite... biz, which was supposed to be the salvation, has now become predictable in a certain kind of bizarre way. Unless you have a celebrity like Bob Dylan, and then everyone wants to hear what's on Dylan's playlist.
I think the big star there is Little Steven.
Absolutely.
I was talking to him once because I was thinking, gee, I wish I could get on this radio thing. Could I do a radio show? And I called him up and he said, so the problem is that the show I do today, in which I can play anything I want, wouldn't get on Sirius Radio today.
No, it's too scripted now.
It's already become compartmentalized. So it couldn't be done. I said, well, okay, I'll forget about that then.
I know, because you want that kind of Little Steven Vince Scalzo of freeform radio, which was, you know, the birth of FM.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when I came into music as a youngster in Ohio, and we had WMMS. Mm-hmm. So we had guys like Kid Leo and
still at it, I think.
Yeah, he actually works for the satellite. I think he works for Sirius, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. But to hear the breadth of music in an afternoon or a morning, whenever you listen to it, or late at night, and to hear the diversity.
If the guy was good, if the DJ was good, unfortunately FM became very self-indulgent. And it'd be guys spinning like a whole side of a record where they snuck outside and smoked a joint or something. But so you'd hear a lot of really... garbage, actually. But the great guys were really, really good. Yeah. Tom Donahue.
Tom Donahue,
Kid Leo, all those guys.
Donahue, wow. Favorite new bands? What have you discovered at eMusic as of late?
Let me see.
What's on the Kurt Loder MP3?
I really like
MP3.
Well, you know, the funny thing about going online and downloading music is you don't know when it's from. It might be 10 years old.
Right.
Who knows? There's a great Danish group called Underbyen, that's not how you pronounce it. I really like them a lot. I like this girl, Annie Clark, who works as under the name St. Vincent. Mm-hmm. And she recorded this album with Mike Garson. He used to be David Bowie's piano player. Really strange guy. He's like a West Coast jazz guy with eyeliner. And he's just so odd. And he produced her record. It's really unusual. Actually, I wrote some stuff down in anticipation of this because my memory is
so
bad.
I love it.
And there's so much.
Sorry.
Switchblade Kittens are a great, great band. They're from L.A. And part of their thing is they all play bass. But the basses have been rigged up electronically, so one bass player is playing bass, one bass player is playing a bass that sounds like guitar, not a big deal. Another one's playing a bass that plays keyboard samples. And the drums are played by a bass.
Wow.
It's so weird. But that's irrelevant. The records are just great punk records. They're so, so good. I love them. Nellie Mackay, everybody loves her.
Nellie is.
And so, what else? There's a great Judy Hensky record from the 60s called Farewell Aldebaran.
Yep.
Which has been out of print for forever.
For a long
just
time.
Just came back.
Isn't Howard doing the press on that? Howard Wolfing?
Howard. Probably, yeah. I don't know. I just found it because I'm a big fan of hers. She should have been a star.
Yeah.
And I really like Licky Lee. We just did an interview with her. She's from Sweden.
Uh-huh.
And she's hooked up with one of the guys from Peter Bjorn and John. And she's just wonderful. And she has videos on YouTube like her and two of her guys will like stand in a closet or something, and they'll have like spoons and a couple of sticks and an acoustic guitar, and they're just totally convincing with their music. She's a great songer.
Oh, that's great.
Licky Lee, L-Y-K-K-E. We love her. And what else?
Have you heard the Ringers from L.A.?
I have not. Are they good?
I saw them at South by Southwest 2 years ago, and they had that Iggy vibe. You know, I mean, Devil May Care, yeah. Lead singer who's become an actor. And there was a little press in the New York Post on him this week, which, you know, was playing up the fact that he's an actor as well. But live, they're fantastic because they have this fuck all attitude, which I think is so missing from a lot of rock and roll, especially the indie music scene, where everyone's so pretentious and so worried about what do I sound like, what do I look like, and they're just like, let's have fun. That's what it's all about. Oh, and the Sex Slaves too. And Gruen's a huge fan of the Sex Slaves. He turned me on to them.
I feel so.
Well, they're a trio from New York that has no footprint at all in New York. They have their footprint on their MySpace tours, you know, and they go out, and again, it's the Devil May Care kind of, you know, three chord rock and roll, and it's great live. You know, the music, the recorded music is okay, but it's the live experience.
It's interesting that these acts get buried because in the age of YouTube and MySpace and you know, just online, there are so many bands. And I think the function of labels was sort of an editing function. You know, they were selecting with their own taste, but they could promote and they could make you stand out from the pack, and it's just an ocean of acts out there. You can't possibly keep up. There's no way to know. It's just very, very much the same thing with movies, because filmmaking technology is so democratic now that everybody can make movies, and everybody does. There are just too many movies, many of them about slackers sitting around talking, which is unfortunate. I just got the new Eagles of Death Metal record, which is coming out in October,
great.
I think. Are they genius or what? I love those guys.
Yeah.
They're just four guys, set up the amps, and there it is, bang. I don't think they even have foot pedals. So that's a really great record.
Lou Reed, two guitarists, drums and
there
bass.
There it is. You know? I mean, it's incredible. What else have I been listening to?
How about jazz? Any, you know, that's a medium. It's hard to find new dynamic jazz players.
Yeah.
You know, Matthew Shipp is a guy I've championed. I love Matthew's playing. Yeah. I love that he's experimenting. He's done 46 records and nobody knows who he is. You know, it's staggering. Henry Rollins was releasing his records for a while.
There's no outlet for that stuff.
No.
I mean,
there's the few tiny clubs that, you know, you can go see Mike Stern play.
Yeah.
You know, at the 55.
There's a new remastered version of Saxophone Colossus, Sonny Rollins record, and it's like, I guess it's really high quality, but I downloaded it.
Of course.
So it doesn't matter if it's high quality. But I'm doing a story now on vinyl. As you know, vinyl's been making a comeback for 10 years. We've been reading these stories. It's so boring. But I was talking to Michael Frimmer about it, and he's a vinyl guy, and he totally hates CDs. And he thinks they're over, which is probably true. He says the real competition to vinyl is going to come from high-quality downloads. And you have really super high quality. You'll pay for it because you have to pay for good stuff. But it'll come very close to vinyl. So who knows? I mean, I love the sound of vinyl, but I hate getting up every 30 minutes to turn the record over.
Oh, gosh, can you imagine?
Yeah, and scratches and all that
stuff.
But you can't compare the sound. I mean,
the experience of shopping for vinyl when we were coming up was just, you could spend hours in a record store and get lost in a cover. Get lost in all those Yes covers, even though you might not like all of the records.
And all the documentation is fabulous.
Yes.
It's just, it was wonderful. It's all been lost. It's a shame. Totally lost with downloading online. I mean, you have no idea. You can go on like iTunes and download something, and it might be like cover versions of something that just, it's not noted. You just bought it.
Yeah, exactly. A re-record of an old song.
Yeah.
Merle Haggard has been doing that a lot lately.
Really? Oh, great. Thank you,
Merle. You buy a Merle record, you're not sure if it's a re-record. And then you read the fine print, you know, when you find the CD, ultimately.
Oh, he's a grumpy old guy. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. But, yeah, it's a shame that happens. It's infuriating, actually.
Yeah.
Do you download a lot of stuff?
I do. And, you know, I'm like you. I'd love to download everything in the highest resolution as possible and keep that. And I'm like you, I have most of the CDs that I really cherish, because what happens if they become, you know, lost? What if your hard drive crashes? Most people don't back up their stuff. And I've had this discussion with an Italian journalist friend of mine. He's just as maniacal as I am about keeping everything that he really, really likes.
Yeah.
Because you just don't know. You don't know if it's going to last. And yeah, I'd love to buy everything in vinyl, but you know, there's only so much wall space, right?
Yeah.
Competing with our books and our movies.
I just had to dump a lot of vinyl. I mean, I couldn't. I didn't have a place. It was like 10,000 records.
Wow.
I just didn't have space for it. So. Whatever.
But, you know, I would love to buy some of the new records. I'd love to hear the Arcade Fire record on vinyl to see how warm it is or isn't.
And just the old, all the Atlantic stuff. I mean, all that stuff is so, that's the way it was recorded for vinyl.
Right.
So there it is. It's not sample little pieces of sound.
And those producers were very understanding of music. Yeah. I mean, we've lost a whole, Jerry Wexler just passed away before I got to interview him. And, you know, there's a guy who was just masterful.
Yeah.
Tom Dowd.
Yeah. They understood the sonics of the studio and what, you know, what level of sound will step on another level and you have to keep it apart. I mean, they're just geniuses about it. Whereas now it's all electronic.
It's squash signal. And this is my complaint. I went to a fashion show, very big designer who will remain nameless. And they were playing terrific 70s music. Mm-hmm. And you could tell it was through an MP3 device because there was no dynamic range. It actually hurt my ears.
Yeah,
and these were great tracks from Slade and Foghat and stuff I hadn't heard in years. And I just thought, why didn't you download at least the high-res AIF file?
That's why DJs use vinyl. I mean, it just sounds so much better. But then you feel like a grumpy old person saying that. You say, you kids, I don't listen to this stuff. I mean, some music is made to be done digitally.
Yes, there's no question.
And it sounds great.
You know, there are bands that I, you know, like the what is the band that I really...
Ratatat.
Ratatat, Fortet.
Yeah.
Bands like that where they're digital, they sound fantastic. Some of the Eno stuff actually sounds very good digital. Yeah.
It's unusual that I just found out that, I know Neil Young just has always hated digital sound, just famously hated it, but he has his own digital facility. Up in, I think it's called Redwood Sound or something.
Right.
But he has a very, very high sampling rate for the stuff he turns out. And I think that's his response to it. He was just so sick of the bad sound that he started doing it himself.
Right.
So, which is that.
Good for Neil.
Again,
so he's waiting for the next wave of
he's pitching in. I mean, the next wave, maybe it'll be a sampling rate that just samples everything.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Just go all the way up.
Right.
And it'll take up your entire hard drive.
Right. Do you have a favorite interview story with someone? Did you care to share, or maybe you want to share that, leave that for the book?
Oh, maybe.
Sorry.
That would be one of the few I remembered. I don't know.
How about recently with any actors, actresses, directors?
Something with Danny Boyle not long ago. I think is a really interesting guy. He's an
terrific
English director,
yeah.
And Sunshine is a great movie. And his thing is he can work within a budget. He doesn't want a huge Hollywood budget. And he's, I can do stuff. I mean, you see Sunshine, it's so beautiful, and it cost like $30 million or something.
Right.
And it's just gorgeous. I mean, you don't really need anything else. What was that other movie, Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow? Do you remember that?
Yep.
That was done on a laptop.
Right. Right.
And it's great to look at. So I love these guys.
Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah, well, I'm not a big fan of his, but he did stuff cheap too. I can't really watch that stuff, but... I don't know. Well, yeah, but you know, the Frank Miller and Rodriguez. I mean, Grindhouse.
Well, you know,
you can't sit through that
movie. Look, you know, let's critically dissect Sin City. I thought it was very overwrought.
It
was stylistic, beautiful, but it's like, you know, I'm so tired of gratuitous violence.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's because I'm getting older too, and I have kids. I don't know what it is, Kurt, but you know, the implied violence of a scene is so much scarier to me because it makes your imagination wonder what's happening behind the door or.
Well, as Martin Amis said, he said, well, I hate violence in real life, but I love it on the screen. But I know what you mean about that. I mean, in Sin City, you'd have stripped down women getting the shit kicked out of them.
Right.
And I just don't find that entertaining at all.
Yeah.
Plus, it goes on forever. That movie could have been 5 minutes. Great style. Now why? It's like going out to see the countryside. A tree. Great. What do we do now? Is there a club nearby?
Right.
So, I agree. I think there's a lot of stuff that's just style. I think... Frank Miller has just done The Spirit, which is the great Will Elder script.
Sure.
And he was friends with Will Elder, apparently. And yet, he's just trashed this character. I mean, it looks like Sin City. It doesn't look like The Spirit.
Right.
It's just going to be, I think it's just going to be a disaster.
I hope not.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
I'll bet. There was actually a, they showed a clip on there was a clip up on YouTube for a while that was so bad, so stupid, that they took it off. Took it off their website. And that's a bad sign.
Yeah, I'm feeling the same thing about The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of my favorite sci-fi movies. Yeah. And, you know, it's getting the big internet push right now.
I think the
piano's playing Klaatu.
I know.
And I'm like, ooh.
What do we expect from these things?
I don't know, man.
I think the big fantasy movie is going to be Watchmen.
Yes.
Watchmen is just one of the greatest books of all time. That's so complex, and I just didn't think it could be done. But it looks like Zack Snyder is actually pulling it off. I mean, the stuff we've seen from it is just amazing. I'm very excited about it.
Years ago, someone gave me one of the first drafts.
Yeah,
and that's a script for those who are listening.
Yeah.
They've rewritten this thing how many times, Kurt?
I know about every couple of scripts.
You know, they've had a lot of different people try to develop the project because it is, as you said, very complex.
Mm.
That trailer looks very compelling.
Yeah, it does.
You know, I mean, I was like, I dropped my jaw in a couple of spots. Yeah. I thought, wow, if they can pull this whole thing together, because it is so cerebral and so metaphysical on so many different levels, and still so.
DC Comics is going to, I know Alan Moore hates the movies made from his books, rightly so, but DC Comics is going to print up like another million copies of this book or something, some fantastic amount. So I think more and more people are going to realize what a great book this is.
I saw somebody reading it the other day on the subway, like a young gal, and it looked like one of the older versions of The Watchmen. And I thought, good for her, man.
Probably very expensive.
Yeah.
There's a guy named Jess Nivens who has a website in which he annotates Alan Moore books. Like, you can get the Watchmen annotation, and they're like 9 million words long. They're so in depth. There's this little item over on the table, and this frame is actually, whoa. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
That's so great. I love annotation. So if you get into Watchmen,
definitely
look up Jeff Nivens, Jason Nivens.
Good tip. Any other movies this fall do you think are going to register with people?
The Coen brothers. W is going to be horrible. I mean, I think that JFK is one of the most interesting movies ever made, but it's just so full of shit. I mean, it's all lies. It's all wrong. And yet it's such a feverish, you know, piece of work. You go, wow, what's the deal with them? You got to see the director's cut, which is actually unwatchable. But it's amazing. Oliver Stone, you know, he's going to do something on George Bush. He hates George Bush. I mean, everybody knows George Bush. What are we supposed to get out of this?
Right.
And it's coming out like a month before the election.
Right.
A little late.
Yeah, exactly.
Who cares? There's also a movie coming out that takes Michael Moore to task. It's a vicious satire of Michael Moore, which has various Hollywood conservatives in it, like Dennis Hopper, and
people are stunned to hear that Hopper is such a, you know, flag-waving conservative.
They are out there.
Yeah.
John Voight and possibly Robert Downey Jr. It's just surprising that they actually exist. But so that's coming out. This is good. The Coen brothers movie.
That looks fun.
Yeah, I hope that'll be good.
There's this big resurgence. Obviously, you probably saw the Rolling Stone piece on The Big Lebowski, which I thought, I had no idea that there's this midnight cult.
It's been going on for a while.
Thing happening here for the last
time. I hate that movie. I just don't understand it. It's like, I thought that was their worst film. The Dude, I don't care.
The Dude Abides.
Whatever. I just thought that was so bad. That was an ending that was obviously whipped up in 5 minutes. How should we end this?
And yet Miller's Crossing, which I think is one of the great movies of in their catalog, is never mentioned.
I know. It's so weird. You know, it's a great movie that was totally underrated is Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which everybody should see. The Chuck Barris story.
Fascinating.
Directed by George Clooney.
Yeah.
It's a great, great piece of work.
Rockwell's wonderful in it.
Yeah, Jim Rockwell's wonderful in it. It's a great take on the 60s and on spy movies. And it's just really, really well done. Nobody's seen it.
Now, is it urban myth?
Well, it's all a lie. I mean,
is a lie. He's never come out to say one way or another. So he's helped fuel the marketing strategy.
I don't think he has to say it. I mean, Chuck Barris, for people who don't know, was a game show host in the 60s, and he claimed to.
He created the Gong Show, and a newlywed show,
dating game. And he claimed to, at the same time he was doing this television stuff, he was also a spy for the CIA.
An assassin.
Hired assassin. So the movie just plays the book as if it were true. And they have all these people, actually New Barris, sort of commenting on it. It's just such a
great film. It's a wonderful movie. Yeah. Very good call. What are some other movies? There's, you know, I love finding these movies that just, you know, we screened Kevin Bacon's movie about the pedophile, The Woodsman, which is a compelling movie.
Yeah.
Obviously, who's going to rent that movie? Yeah. You know, it's so dark. And I recently saw a movie that has yet to find a distribution company called Cook County, about crack cocaine, that is extremely disturbing and really, really well done.
There's another Kevin Bacon movie called Where the Truth Lies, which is also great. Colin Firth is in it. It's about two, like, Martin and Lewis comics. And it's just, that's set in the 50s too, and they, of course they break up, and it's just nasty.
It was a Toronto bit, wasn't that?
It was an Adam McGuinn movie.
Yeah.
It's great. Nobody's going to see it. I mean, there's lots of graphic sex in it, and it's really well done, but seek it out. There's also another one, what was that called? Searching for a Midnight Kiss, which just came out this year, is another great movie. It's from Austin, and it's wonderful. It's an American indie that is not a piece of crap.
Right.
It's really well done.
Yeah, Junebug was like that last year.
Yeah.
Junebug was a really... It skewed differently because it was more of a heart, you know, just a small movie that had a lot of heart, I thought.
Yeah. I just got hold of, I think I got it here, actually, The Magnificent Ambersons.
Ah.
This is a sad story. This great movie by Orson Welles, and of course he, like an idiot... When it was done, he just said, well, I've got to leave the country. And he handed it over to the studio. He said, yeah, put it out. And the studio mutilated it. They just hated it. And they put a very embarrassing happy ending on the end. So everybody knows this. But you can't get this movie in the United States now. It's not in print. It's one of the greatest movies. And
it's not in print. Criterion, no one's released
it. No one. There's some sort of rights thing going on.
Right.
But I got a copy from this VHS place. And it's, you know, from Brazil or something. But it's a Turner. Remember when Ted Turner was colorizing black and white movies? This is one of those. I was so angry. And I emailed the guy back, and I said, and he didn't realize it. He said, God, it's disgusting. So he found this other one, which he sent me. I'm very happy, and now I have that. It's a great movie, but I don't know where you're going to see it.
Oh, God.
There are, Criterion finds guys to round up all this old footage. I think they did some sort of archival version of Mr. Arkadine, the Wells movie.
Right.
And they find this stuff, and they get it together, but then they put it out, and there are three different versions of the movie, and you say, well, whatever. I just want to see the movie originally seen. But so many movies have been just torn apart by distributors and cut down, and just tracking down all this old footage is an enormous job. And the people that will invest money in this, how many of them are there? God bless Martin Scorsese.
Right. We're losing these movies, are just disintegrating, basically, these old movies.
Yeah,
they have to be captured. If they're not, they're gone.
Yeah. And Frank Zappa told me once, because he recorded for MGM Verve in the 60s, and he said he went to try and get their early records back, like Reuben and the Jets and Freak Out and stuff, and they were kept in a cardboard box in a hot warehouse for like 30 years. And he couldn't use them anymore. The bass tracks were gone, and the drum tracks were just gone.
Right. This is magnetic tape that will dissolve. People don't understand that.
And he had to bring people in to re-record those parts, and they just screwed it all up. I can't even listen to that stuff. I mean, you have to have the original records for that, which is
interesting. I wonder how many other records have fallen into that trap.
I'm sure there are many.
Yeah.
Because they haven't been stored well. I know when they started putting out the Buddy Holly stuff again in a serious way, MCA did, and Steve Hoffman told me that he was in their warehouse and he tripped over a cardboard box and it had the original Buddy Holly tapes in it, and it was just lying in a store. He said, what is this? And it's frightening, you know. I mean, it can never be replaced, obviously,
right?
And people should take better care of it. I think they are taking better care of it now, but it's been through, the music has been through some rough times, the tapes.
And there's some Buddy Holly, the barn rehearsals are coming out.
Yeah. All his stuff is, I can't imagine there's much more.
Yeah.
But there's stuff that was on vinyl that will never be on CD. I mean, there's some great song you love that was a B-side of something, you'll never hear that again.
Right.
There are albums that nobody bought, but you bought it and you loved it, but you'll never hear that again.
I know, I had this discussion about, remember David Warner?
Yeah.
He was the glam guy out of Philly.
Yeah.
And his record.
Jabriath.
Jabriath, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, Jabriath. No, actually, Morrissey released it through Sanctuary.
Shocker.
But not everything. but not everything.
Not everything.
Yeah. It was weird. They made him do a truncated version, you know, of his best tracks.
I guess they probably did,
yeah.
Whereas the Joe Breyer reissue has extra tracks.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess it balances out.
Go figure.
Yeah.
That, you know, we were talking about this earlier before the tape was rolling. The whole plasma screen phenom and watching movies now and how unsettling it is, these huge screens in our living rooms. And, you know, digital technology and filmmaking leaves a lot to be desired. I miss the quality of film. Yeah. I miss the experience of black and white or the depth of field.
Yeah, and you also miss the cathode ray tube, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were just huge. They took up a lot of space, but they had something. And these widescreen, I have one. I mean, everybody has one. But yeah, it's a little scary. And if you're playing VHS, everybody has VHS lying around somewhere. You just see every imperfection, every flaw, and the color won't be right. It's pretty horrifying. So it has to be very well balanced.
And this Blu-ray stuff now, this hyper-reality, everything looks like Pleasantville. It's like a take on Pleasantville, right?
It's just glowing at you.
Right.
It's amazing. You know, Hellboy on Blu-ray is pretty, pretty amazing.
Right. Transformers, Hellboy, those spectacle movies, the CGI-driven movies look great. They do. And the animated stuff looks fantastic.
The farther away from the screen you are, the better. I mean, I'm forced to have it set up so I'm a little too close, and then it's kind of annoying.
Well, that's the Metro experience being in New York. We don't have the depth of field, and we don't have huge spaces.
Either you have a bed or a TV.
Right.
You know, so you have to make this choice.
Right. So, Kurt, your book, when is the official release date? Do you have one?
It'll be out like 2022. Soft date. Soft date. I mean, I don't know. I've been trying to get this done for years, and it's just hard. You sit down and you say, okay, where do I start? And then you sit there for like half an hour, then you get up and you go have a drink or something.
And you have a website?
No.
You're not right. You don't have a KurtLoader.com?
I wrote, no. That'd be terrible.
Come on.
I write a movie column for MTV.com, an unusual place to have it, every week. It goes up every Friday or Wednesday whenever movies come out, and it gets picked up by Google. It goes all over the place.
Right.
So that's great. So I really enjoy that. I go to a lot of movies, and I try not to go to too many. I mean, if you go to these screenings with other critics or reviewers, as I like to think of them, they've always already seen two movies in the morning. And they're on their way to three others, and you can't do that. It's like listening to music all the time.
Yeah,
you need the silence. So important.
That in itself must be daunting with the release schedule now of movies, as you said earlier. There's so much.
Yeah.
You know, how do you? And I'm sure you have favorites like I do. Publicists who you know you can kind of count on. Their movies are pretty good.
Yeah, I just I was talking to Owen Gleiberman, who writes for Entertainment Weekly, and he had that same problem too. He says, "Who can see all this stuff?
Right?
There's just too much of it, and some of it may be good, but you're never going to see it. It's really a shame, but you try."
Well, Kurt, thanks for being on the show. We
appreciate it. A great pleasure.
And please, when his book is out, and check him out. Kurt, come on, let's get your website going.
Go to MTV.com, movies.
Or maybe somebody will annotate all of your writings and put it on KurtLoader's biggestfan.com.
Oh, that's a scary thought.
You never know.
I think everybody gets caught up in blockbusters and stuff. I'm very interested in comics, comic movies. The movies generally don't serve the comics very well. But I'm waiting for Fables to be made into a movie, because Fables is one of the greatest of comic book series, and everybody should check it out.
Fables.
Fables.
I don't know that one.
It's absolutely unbelievably good.
I felt the same.
Bill Willingham.
Okay, Bill Willingham. I felt the same way about Peter Baggy and Hate.
I don't know that one.
East Coast guy that moved to Seattle and was a big serial kind of. He's got this kind of Gary Panter style, you know, that very punky, edgy stuff.
Mm.
His newest title is Apocalypse Nerd. What happens if a nuke hits Seattle and people have to struggle? It's like the comic version of The Road, which of course we'll see this fall.
Yeah, it's coming
up. McCarthy. But that's another one. Flaming Carrot was my other favorite.
Yeah. That's good. There's a what else is coming out? Apparently, Alan Moore is doing a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen 3. We're not counting the dossier, and that could be interesting. Although it was made into the first one was made into the worst movie, comic book movie.
They destroyed it.
All his books are made into bad movies. From Hell, they just trashed that. It's a shame. So that's why we hold out so much hope for Watchmen.
All right.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Let's go have some lunch.
Okay.
Thanks.
but don't be scared. I'm too smooth, you never see me coming. I'm never in a hurry, I'm just moving fast. I said, ow! Yeah, baby, here I stand, I'm your impossible man. I said, ho! Yes, I said, ho! I came to make a bang. I said, ho! Yeah, I said, ho! I came to make a bang. Yeah, ho!
That's a track by the Eagles of Death Metal. Don't Speak, I Came to Make a Bang. That's one of Kurt's favorite bands, and I love that track by those guys. I'd like to thank Kurt Loder for being on the show today, and I'd like to thank our sponsor, Napa Piri. Visit them at napajri.com. And if you've liked this program, please leave a comment in the iTunes directory. Just type in Culture Catch in the iTunes directory and write a review for us. It helps in our ranking. This is Dusty Wright for the Culture Catch. Converge is the word. See you soon.
Influencing the influencers. Smart culture. CultureCatch.com.